Niger is the latest African country to fall to a coup. Its neighbors are reacting firmly with strong measures.
They included closing the land and air borders with Niger, implementing a no-fly zone for commercial planes, travel bans, and asset freezes.
Also today, in Germany's Black Forest, a climate warning. The forest is getting greener.
Most people think, wow, yeah, it's a good sign, because if something gets greener, we have less concrete and more nature.
But the wrong kind of green is pushing out biodiversity. And the women in organized crime we don't hear about. Our guest smashes gender stereotypes behind some of the most infamous drug cartels.
Women who are mothers and sisters and wives are also capable of criminality.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this week. We begin today in the African nation of Niger. Last week, a military coup. This week, a growing chorus of international condemnation and threats of harsh economic consequences. Over the weekend, supporters of the coup marched through Niger's capital, Niamey, with Russian flags. They also set fire to part of the French embassy, the country's former colonial power. It is the latest of several coups in Africa's Sahel region in recent years. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, has been following all of this. Halima, what reaction are we seeing globally to the military coup in Niger?
Well, broadly, there have been condemnations and calls for Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, to be reinstated. The European Union has said that they do not recognize this military junta, and the U.S. has said that their cooperation with Niger is at risk.
And what has been the reaction from the regional economic organization, ECOWAS?
Well, ECOWAS leaders met in Nigeria over the weekend to discuss what the response should be, and they concluded and agreed to implement a few immediate steps, which included closing the land and air borders with Niger, implementing a no-fly zone for commercial flights, and also implementing travel bans and asset freezes for the military leaders involved in the coup. So it was a rather strong response. And ultimately, they demanded for the release and reinstatement of the president, Mohamed Bazoum, within 1 week. Here's what ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré said they were prepared to do if that didn't happen.
Take all measures necessary to restore constitutional order in the Republic of Niger. Such measures may include the use of force.
Use of force, Halima, that sounds pretty serious. We have to remember, though, that there have been several coups d'etat in the region in recent years. Guinea, Mali, two coups in Burkina Faso. Why has ECOWAS issued such a strong statement for this one in Niger?
Well, I think it's exactly because there have been so many coups in recent years that ECOWAS probably felt required to issue such a strong statement. I mean, they did issue condemnations for the coups that happened in Mali and Burkina Faso and Guinea in recent years, and eventually economic sanctions did follow, although some of them were later lifted. But right now, ECOWAS is facing a big credibility issue because of those coups. And if another one happens at this time when it's a mandate within ECOWAS to not allow unconstitutional changes of power, there's a big question about what power ECOWAS has in the region.
As to the whereabouts of deposed President Mohamed Bazoum, do we know where he is?
It seems that he's still under detention in the presidential palace, and ECOWAS has called it an active hostage situation. One of the first pictures of him came recently, and that was released by Chad's interim president, Mahamat Debi, who arrived in Niger over the weekend to help mediate the situation. And in the picture, he's sitting next to President Bazoum, smiling. Of course, he himself is a military leader who also came into power against the constitutional norms.
Halima, has the pressure from countries in the region had any effect on the military leaders in this coup in Niger?
It doesn't seem so. If anything, the military leaders seem to have, in some ways, amped up their presence. If you look at the public TV and radio stations, it's all very pro-military. The military leaders have suspended the constitution. They created what they're calling the National Council for the Safeguarding of the Fatherland, which is being led by Abdurrahmane Tiani, and this is what he said to the public on Friday. He said that their motivations were to protect the country, and he cited the deterioration of the security situation. He said that the European Union hasn't been able to help them with the crisis. He also mentioned the poor economy and issues with governance in Niger. And again, those messages have been repeated on the public broadcasters, which have also released videos of that seem to show pro-military demonstrators and across the country. They also met with government ministers and then later directed those officials to return to work on Monday. So it seems like they're trying to project a message of calm and normalcy after their coup.
What's been the reaction in Niger?
Well, it seems to be quite mixed, although, of course, a lot of the messages that are coming out of the news stations within Niger are pro-military. That said, on social media, there were some videos of pro-democracy demonstrations that seemed to be in support of President Bazoum. But on the other hand, there were also demonstrations on social media that seemed to show a strong support for the military. And with that came anti-France messages. Of course, France has strong historical ties with Niger, and then also a large military presence. And in those demonstrations, people were saying that they do not want the French military or the French government meddling in the country anymore. And those are the same type of sentiments I saw in Mali during the coup a few years ago. And it seems like the military is trying to leverage those sentiments. And also on state media, we saw some interviews with Nigerians who were pro-military supporters. And in those demonstrations that were featured on state media, in some cases, people were holding Russian flags as well, which was very curious.
Yeah, I mean, those Russian flags, I mean, we know the Wagner Group has a growing presence in the region, in Mali specifically. Any sense of what role Wagner may have played here or may be playing in the future?
It's not clear what role they played or might play in the future. I mean, if we talk about the Russian government, Moscow last week called for the release of President Bazoum. But if you're talking about the Wagner Group in particular, there were reports that the leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was applauding the military coup, and he might see this as an opportunity to expand the presence of Wagner in Niger, because, of course, in other countries, there's a large presence. But regarding the actual waving of the Russian flags, it's not clear how they got there. But I remember during the coup in Mali, you saw a similar presence of Russian flags during pro-military demonstrations.
I mean, just at a general regional level, Halima, what does this coup in Niger mean for the Sahel region at large?
Well, at first, it puts to question the future of the whole democratic practice within the region. I mean, many of these military coups that have happened, the leaders have since promised to return the countries to democratic elections within the near future. But it seems like that timeline keeps moving forward. So it's possible that military leadership might be the new again normal in this region. And while security has been used as a defense for many of these military leaders, they've yet to prove that they can actually improve the insecurity within their countries that they're using to justify these military takeovers. And of course, they've also jeopardized any future support from countries like France and the United States and the European Union through these coups. So we'll have to see whether they can actually deliver the security that they're promising to their populations.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Germany's Black Forest is the backdrop for countless fairy tales, but there's a darker story emerging about a loss of biodiversity that's hard to see with the naked eye. Put simply, the pretty scenery masks a worrying trend. Emily Havoc reports from the Kohlhutte Nature Reserve in southwestern Germany.
Thomas Sparla is holding up a 50-year-old photo of this exact spot in this exact bog.
In this part of the bog, there were no trees.
The photo shows a marshy area with water winding through the grass. Today, it's mostly dry.
And nowadays, a lot of trees.
These trees represent new growth. But in a bog, a tall tree is not a sign of life.
The trees are a sign that the water level in the ground of the bogs is sinking.
In 2017, Sparla started surveying dozens of bogs just like this one in Germany's Black Forest. For 3 years, he counted plants, some just a few centimeters long. He often spent nights in his camper van.
And I also made lists.
He compared his new lists to a survey from 50 years ago.
I find out that nowadays much less species are growing.
Two plant species have gone extinct. And several more will likely disappear in the next 15 years.
If this trend in the future will go on, we have the extinction of, I think, 10 species in all the bogs.
The plants that are dying out are mostly what's called specialists. They do well in a very specific setting, while generalists that can thrive almost anywhere are increasing. Sparla and his research partner, Helga Bruhlheide, attribute the homogenization to hot, dry summers from climate change.
It results in a type of globalization, so you lose the difference between different habitats.
Bruhlheide is a professor of geobotany at Martin Luther University in Halle, Germany. In another study in northern Germany, he found that over two decades, the landscape had gotten greener.
Most people think, wow, yeah, it's a good sign, because if something gets greener, we have less concrete and more nature.
But in this case, greener meant a loss of other colors.
Colorful meadows have disappeared. Less colorful flowers mean you have less pollinators.
Insect biodiversity itself relies on plant diversity.
Elizabeth Borer does research at the University of Minnesota. She's looking at biodiversity through a more experimental lens.
Often trying to simulate something like what future Earth might look like.
As humans burn fossil fuels, we're releasing more than just carbon. Nitrogen and other nutrients are going into the air and falling back down in the rain. Borer simulates these higher nutrient levels in a controlled setting to see what happens to plant biodiversity.
What we see there is a continued loss of species from those areas.
More nutrients might sound like a good thing.
If you have a single outcome in mind, which is more plant, you are likely to get more plant.
There's more vegetation overall in the short term because those generalist plants are really thriving. But they're often crowding out the specialist plants, so biodiversity declines.
The little seedlings or small statured plants don't have light resources they need.
What does a loss of biodiversity actually mean for our planet? Fewer plants mean fewer pollinators, which are important for food production. Plants also store carbon and keep it out of our atmosphere. Bogs are especially good at this.
The bogs are holding carbon dioxide in very great size.
Back in the Black Forest, Thomas Sparla says if nothing is done, these bogs could disappear completely by the end of the century. So he's moving from research to action.
This is a very small tree. It is also a specialist of bogs.
This variety of birch tree, about the size of a bonsai, was almost extinct for lack of water. And unlike taller generalist trees, this tiny one is supposed to be here. So Sparla had an idea.
We've taken water from a little stream.
They used a tube to bring that water to the shrub and managed to stabilize the 40 remaining plants. It's just one small species, but every loss has untold consequences for the planet.
We don't know exactly what role every species or every system of species has, and we cannot say, oh, that's going away, it's nothing. No, no.
Sparla says it will take both research and action to find out what kind of extinctions our trees and green spaces might be hiding and keep any more species from disappearing. For The World, I'm Emily Havik in Germany's Black Forest.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last night, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said the war is returning to the territory of Russia. He called it an inevitable, natural, and absolutely fair process. The war already arrived in Russia this weekend. And just a heads up here, we're about to play a few seconds of sound of an explosion and a frightened bystander. The cell phone video is taken before dawn in Moscow's business district. No one was hurt. Samuel Bendett has seen that video. He's an expert on drone warfare and a member of the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analyses. Samuel Bendett, this was not the first attack on targets in Russia. What made yesterday's drone strikes in Moscow different?
Well, I would say they targeted one of the landmarks in the city. The Moscow City Business District is a brand new district, like a small downtown, which is supposed to look very similar to similar business districts in North America, Europe, Middle East, or Asia. The fact that drones were able to strike means either that air defenses weren't functioning that well, or if we are to believe the Russian Defense Ministry, They actually were intercepted by electronic warfare, but instead of downing them somewhere else, they basically veered off course.
Yeah, I mean, the explosion we heard, the wailing of frightened civilians, these do not sound like Russian air defenses are doing their job. So what is the Russian strategy to defend its cities against drones?
I would say there are multiple strategies. There's a lot of discussion about what kind of weapons and systems should be placed in and around Moscow. There are multiple threat levels. Some drones are actually downed well before they reach Moscow. Some fall within the Moscow region. Some are relatively small. These seemed like larger ones, maybe the ones that have attacked Moscow before. This is a psychological attack, if it was intended as such. And certainly screaming civilians in Moscow is a response to Russia's continued attacks on Ukrainian civilian infrastructure.
So let's talk about the drones themselves. If they were sent by Ukraine, where would Ukraine have sourced them? Could they have been American made?
Well, actually, Ukraine has a very developed drone industry already. And many drones that have attacked Russia before were identified as Ukrainian domestically manufactured drones.
What do we know about how these drones would have been piloted and just where the pilots would be located?
Well, these could be piloted via satellite. They could be piloted via Starlink. They could be piloted via predetermined coordinates. They could have been piloted from inside Ukraine. They could also have been piloted from inside Russia as well.
You're saying, though, it's really difficult to tell whether these drones were piloted from inside or outside Russia.
Yeah, I would not venture to comment in the absence of any details at this point.
So today, Russian missiles struck an apartment building in Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown, Kryvyi Rih, but Russia is also attacked with drones. How big a role are drones playing in the war today, and how many do either side have in their arsenal?
It's a very significant role, and this role has grown from month to month the longer this war continued. There are multiple types of drones used by both sides, from long-range, one-way kamikaze-type drones, like the ones we just discussed on the Ukrainian side, and the Iranian-provided Shahed drones, which fly under the Russian name of Geran.
How big are the stockpiles of drones that both sides, Russia and Ukraine, have available to them?
Well, it's a difficult question, but even if we can't nail an actual number, we can say that both countries' stocks are significant and rising.
As we heard, Volodymyr Zelensky indicated that attacks on Russian soil are inevitable. What are you going to be watching for now with the war as you assess what kind of escalation, you know, those words represent?
I'll be watching for a truly mass-scale attack because Ukraine has been building up its attacks and complexity. I'll be watching for a true mass-scale strike with dozens, if not hundreds, of drones against a specific city or a specific military base to really stress out air defenses and to make damage completely unavoidable.
Yeah, so when you say mass scale, Samuel, are you talking sustained over time or a kind of shock and awe moment that might happen in a single evening?
Both, actually. In fact, as we have heard from the eyewitness video, the shock and awe can have a very significant effect, especially if people are completely unprepared or think that something like that can't really happen in their city.
Samuel Bendett, drone warfare expert and a member of the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis, CNA. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In France, tensions have been high since June. That's when, as you'll recall, police near Paris shot and killed a teenager of Algerian descent. Now in the southern city of Marseille, a young man who survived a vicious attack is telling his story for the first time. The alleged attackers were police officers, and one of them remains jailed pending an investigation. That has sparked outrage among fellow officers in Marseille. From Embrun, France, the world's Jerry Haddon has the latest.
Eddy, as the victim's known, says he still can't look in a mirror. The 22-year-old restaurant manager of Arab descent looks straight at the camera in this interview with French outlet Kobini News. You can see a third of his skull is just gone. It looks like some sort of Hollywood special effect. Eddy was walking home from work in Marseille in early July. It was during the nationwide riot sparked by the death of 17-year-old Nahel Merzouk during a traffic stop near Paris days earlier. Eddy says, I passed a group of riot police, said good evening. Then something knocked me to the ground. That something was a rubber stun ball fired from close range by one of the police. Eddy says the officers then beat him till his jaw broke. When the police finally left, Eddy says, I reached for my head, but I couldn't find my skull. My hand touched something round, something bulging out. Four police officers have been suspended for their involvement. One of them's parked in pretrial detention as investigators piece together events. He's the second officer jailed this summer in France. The first is the traffic cop who shot Merzouk in June. Merzouk's death sparked 6 nights of unrest across France's disenfranchised suburbs, where many youth of African descent say they're systematically harassed by law enforcement.
Il y a une instrumentalisation inacceptable.
At the time, French President Emmanuel Macron called Merzouk's death unacceptable, and he called for calm. But since then, he's gradually taken a harder line against protesters, especially now with tensions high in Marseille. Police there have been calling in sick to protest their colleagues' detention or refusing to patrol. They say they're the victims of incessant attacks by violent street criminals. France's national police chief said this weekend he agreed. He said it was wrong to jail officers during investigations, no matter what they're suspected of. That caused a wave of indignation in the French press, but the government is clearly closing ranks.
La leçon que j'en tire, c'est un, l'ordre, l'ordre, l'ordre.
Order, 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 said President Macron on national TV just days ago. We must reestablish authority at all levels, he said, including within families. That was a nod to those who blamed the parents of young suburban rioters for the violence. But for Eddy, the victim still recovering from the police beating in Marseille, the politics amount to nothing. He has to wear a helmet now to protect his open skull. He's crippled by migraines and has partially lost his vision. A TV interviewer asks him what he most wants.
De redevenir comme avant. De retrouver ma vie d'avant.
To be like I was before, to get my life back, he says. That'd be great. If police in Marseille, France's second largest city, continue their pseudo-strike for long, it could spell disaster for Macron. And it could create an opening for France's powerful far-right National Rally Party, which campaigns on law and order. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, en Brun, France.
China's big farming dilemma, how to feed a fifth of the world's population with only 7% of the world's arable land. There's also this to complicate things.
If you rely on the international markets, there could be a lot more volatility that is out of your control.
Why China still very much needs to play nice with U.S. farmers, that's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In northwest Pakistan, people are reeling after a massive bombing at a political rally on Sunday. At least 44 people were killed and hundreds more were injured. Leaders of an ultra-conservative political party are among the dead. Late today, the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the explosion. The blast is deepening rivalries between feuding militant groups and leading many to ask about the viability of elections and why Pakistan's government can't protect civilians. I spoke with Aisha Siddiqa earlier today. She's a senior fellow at King's College, London. There are a lot of groups vying for power in Pakistan, Aisha, and it's easy to get lost in the acronyms of these organizations. Still, it's rivalries that are kind of key to understanding what's happened at this rally of a pro-Taliban political party on Sunday, right?
Yeah. The rally was of Jamaat-e-Ulama-e-Islam, Fazlur Rahman group. They're close to the Taliban. And initially, when the United States fought its war in Afghanistan during the 1980s to push out Russian invasion, JUI and Jamaat-e-Islami were the groups, the religious groups, which mainly proselytized, that were kind of used to inspire mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight. And so now what we see is reaping the harvest, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like one group is trying to outdo the other in terms of jihadism, it seems. Just a basic question, how were militants able to detonate such a huge device in such a public setting?
Protection is very difficult, from suicide jackets to material to make larger devices. They have acquired the expertise to do it. There is already a battle going on between the Taliban and the ISIS and the Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and as to why these ultra-conservative groups are feuding, I mean, is this about ideology, Aisha, or is it just a raw struggle for power? What's going on?
It's a mix of both. Let's also not forget that the Afghan Taliban themselves are a network of varied networks. So there isn't that strict discipline that we saw during the 1990s when Mullah Omar was in charge and he made the Taliban movement. This is, I think, because the Afghan Taliban of today are more ideological. They're deeply ideological. So when the world tells them, to educate women, not to stop women from getting educated, to let them work. They don't care because they're very ideological. Their pragmatism is dealing with the world. They'll take their money, but not what the world is telling them. Now, in the same way, there are groups within the Taliban who are more ideological. So the TTP, which is attacking Pakistan, is more ideological. It wants to now spread the shadows of its ideology into Pakistan. There is a battle to control Pakistan, to come and occupy those areas and implement their Sharia there.
What does the bombing tell us about the strength of the Pakistani state?
It's lack of options. I mean, right now, the army chief, the new army chief, Asim Munir, General Asim Munir, is sending messages. And he says that the groups, they know where people are hiding, and he intends to punish them. The problem is, can he do that? Does Pakistan have the capability? I mean, Pakistan right now is in the throes of economic problems. It's begging and borrowing from different countries, from China to Saudi Arabia to UAE and even IMF, and struggling with money. So to have a war land at your doorsteps instead is not an easy option.
Pakistani political scientist Aisha Siddiqa is a senior fellow at King's College London. She's been speaking with us about the suicide bombing that tore through a political rally in northwest Pakistan yesterday. Aisha, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The incredible growth in China over the past half century has also brought major changes in diet and agriculture. The country has gone from periodic famines to being a major food exporter. It also imports some staples, and that's been good for places like the U.S. So says Arthur Kroeber, who runs a consultancy on China's economy and global influence.
As long as China sort of played by the rules of the global economic system, it would be fine.
But China hasn't always played by the rules. From the national security podcast, Things That Go Boom, Lacey Healy has this story of rivalry and interdependence around food.
It's probably an understatement to say that President Richard Nixon, when he made his historic trip to Beijing in 1972, didn't foresee China becoming the economic powerhouse it is today. In less than two decades, China became the largest country trading in goods. And by the 1990s, it was starting to seriously compete with the U.S., and not always on equal terms. Here's Joe Biden at the State Department in 2012.
As Americans, we welcome competition, but cooperation can only be mutually beneficial if the game is fair.
And that tension has become the bedrock of the U.S.-China relationship.
They are taking advantage of us, okay?
It doesn't help that the country's penchant for intellectual property theft has increasingly seemed to yield real results for China that go beyond the agricultural sector.
It's actually more of a severe threat because China was theoretically using this misappropriation of IP to create direct competitors to U.S. technology companies or to strengthen its military.
And the narrative around China's leader Xi Jinping, that's changed too. With 1.4 billion people to feed and a party narrative to keep up, she is more focused on food security than ever. Here's Su Lin Wang. She's a journalist at The Economist and the host of The Prince, a podcast about Xi.
There was a lot of speculation, both among Chinese people, but also foreign journalists and China watchers, that Xi Jinping might be pretty open and a bit of a reformer because his dad was known to have that kind of attitude, but that turned out to not be the right conclusions to draw.
Over the past 10 years, Xi Jinping has made China much less free, much more closed, and much more authoritarian.
He is driven by this absolute fear of chaos, an obsession with control. There are all these people very, very loyal to Xi Jinping at the very top of the party now, and there is a real emphasis on national security. So everything in China now is framed around what are the national security implications of this. And national security is very, very broadly defined and defined by the Chinese Communist Party. And of course, food security is one of these national security priorities.
And if you hear Xi talk about his vision for China, more often than not, you'll hear him wax about self-sufficiency, says Arthur Kroeber, the China consultant that we heard from earlier. He talks about the holding of the food bowl.
So there is a very strong desire to make sure, as a matter of basic governance, that everyone in China can be adequately fed. And that's no easy task, given that China has essentially 20% of the world's population, but only 7% of the world's arable land. There's always this concern, you know, we, China, are a lonely country. We have no allies. What if we get in a big war with someone? We have to be able, in a really bad situation like that, to meet the basic needs of our population.
Which is why this effort to become self-sufficient, it doesn't just apply to food. Under the Xi administration, China has rolled out several major initiatives aimed at modernizing the country. Initiatives that could have a real impact on China's food supply. But also, a real impact on China's standing as a major power. First, there's the Belt and Road Initiative,
which was a huge sort of infrastructure investment program around the world.
This involves partnering with nearly 150 countries to expand global trade routes and policy.
And then the Made in China 2025 industrial policy program, which was unveiled in 2015, which a lot of people came to see, again, as an effort by China to become a peer competitor to the U.S. in a lot of the technologically intensive industries that are really critical to the U.S. economy.
Something that the U.S. found more than a little annoying. But for China, this is sort of a catch-22. The country wants to grow and prosper and, yes, compete with other world powers. But it needs to feed its people. No matter how you slice it, that means investing in itself. Which is partly why the country plans to produce 90% of its own agricultural equipment by 2025. And related to that goal, build up its seed industry. See, genetically modified seeds can be designed to yield more crops, fight pests, and withstand increasing climate stress.
This is China's largest freshwater lake turned bone dry.
Authorities are battling one of the worst droughts seen in more than 50 years. Falling river levels have left hydroelectric power stations unable to produce enough energy.
So it's not just a matter of can we feed our population, but can we feed our population with a minimal reliance on imports?
And even that can be a challenge. Wen Dongzhang, an economics professor at Cornell University with a focus on agriculture, said that trade can carry its own risks.
More recently, with the U.S.-China trade war and the Russian-Ukraine situation, where this is exposed that if you rely on the international markets, there could be a lot more volatility that is out of your control. China is so big that even if you have a 10% shortage for the wheat and rice production, for example, there's no other countries can quickly produce this massive quantity.
China's answer has been to diversify its trade, sometimes for political benefit as much as keeping the shelves stocked. China's been increasing its food imports, for example, from countries like Brazil, which can send a less obvious but equally powerful message to its top frenemy.
One thing that's been very interesting feature of both the Trump and Biden administrations is that while the relationship has grown a lot more contentious on many dimensions, there has been a very, very active effort to promote U.S. agricultural exports to China.
Some of America's reddest states, represented by Congress's biggest China hawks, rely on the country to buy billions of dollars in corn, soybeans, and more.
And I think from the Chinese perspective, it's useful to have that kind of as a bargaining chip. But the general political or ideological atmosphere in the foreign states tends to be much more conservative than the country as a whole, tends to be a little bit on the libertarian side of things. So to the degree that politicians from these states represent not just the material interests of this or that industry, but also kind of a political ideology or ethos, they are, you know, very disposed to view China as a problem.
Food production in the U.S. is more closely connected to China than many people realize. Smithfield Foods controls about a quarter of the U.S. pork market, and it's owned by a company in Hong Kong.
So there's very strong support in farm country for a lot of sales to China. For Trump, because a lot of his political support came from the rural states.
The Smithfield acquisition happened in 2013. The purchase created enough of a stir in Washington to get the company's CEO yanked in front of the Senate Agricultural Committee. Here's former Senator Pat Roberts, a Republican from Kansas.
I mean, did you expect that this committee would hold a hearing on the acquisition?
I don't know that I contemplated that, no.
Did you realize you were the victim of a Chinese communist plot?
Senator, I did not. To this moment, I'm not sure I understand. I'm the victim of a communist plot.
And the control of your company somehow to allow China to control the pork industry?
Senator, I was not aware of that.
Well, the owner are dead, so you be careful here.
For what it's worth, last year, Smithfield opened a 20 million cubic foot automated distribution center in northwest Kansas. That's 15 times the size of the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. Today, red state representatives walk a bizarre tightrope. Success means talking just enough smack about China to earn credit with your constituents, but not so much that you get a call from the Farm Bureau.
During the Trump administration, there was a lot of antagonistic rhetoric on China, and there were these export controls and tariffs put on. But there was also continuous negotiations for a trade deal.
But the general antagonism isn't always one-sided. China can be equally unwilling to negotiate or take responsibility for its own problematic behavior, like IP theft.
People need to understand that the relationship is complex and interdependent. It is not reducible to a set of, you know, two or three moral axioms. There are trade-offs which are really complicated to make, and we're not going to make those trade-offs in the best way unless we air all of the issues, you know, very publicly and very thoroughly.
Sometimes it feels weird to personify countries. But even though this is a pretty niche part of the U.S.-China relationship, it's hard not to compare their respective journeys with food to the overall arc of their diplomacy. America has long seen itself as the global agricultural leader and innovator.
The way Mr. Blasey feels about his farm goes deeper than profit and loss. His farm is as much a part of him as his head.
It was the first country to industrialize its food supply, the home of the world's first tractor.
There's evil in the world just the way there's good. And in a way, being a farmer means being on the side of what's good in nature and helping it to live and grow and protecting it against all the things that try to hurt it or kill it.
And it's also a country whose policy and leaders haven't totally reckoned with the reality of co-sharing global leadership.
They've said, look, the story of the world today is of a contest between democratic and authoritarian regimes. We believe in the U.S. that democracy is better. The subtext of that, which they will not say, is like, we have to prove that the United States can deliver as well for its people as the Communist Party has delivered for its people for the last 20 years in China. And I think a lot of people in the Biden administration in Washington would deny this. But to me, that's the fundamental difference. We no longer consider it to be in the national interest for China to be highly successful economically. We can't prevent them from being successful if they work really hard on that, but we can throw some sand in the gears.
From the party's perspective, they see America and its allies as doing everything that they can to keep China down. They think that the West is selfish and wants to keep power in the West and is denying the inevitable, which is the rise of China.
And I think that's something often that's missed over here, is that a very large proportion of people who are alive in China today have personal memories of basically not having enough to eat. And the fact that this is no longer a problem is a huge choice, source of pride. So food is authentically, I think, quite central in Chinese culture generally, but also this move from what was fundamentally, until the mid-1980s, a food-short country where a lot of people were somewhat hungry a lot of the time, to one where this is not an issue. Yeah, that is quite salient in people's psychology today.
For The World, I'm Lacey Healy.
This story is an excerpt from the national security podcast, Things That Go Boom. Hear more of Lacey's reporting on Xi Jinping's personal connections to Iowa farming wherever you find podcasts. Think of the image of a drug kingpin, and I'm guessing it's a man that comes to mind. Pablo Escobar, El Chapo, or the fictional ones like Scarface. The best-known Latin American drug traffickers are men, but in a new book, writer Deborah Bonello explores the women, both in charge of large narcotics trafficking rings and playing key roles behind the scenes. Bonella's book is Narcos, The Secret Rise of Women in Latin America's Cartels. Deborah joins me from Mexico City. So early on in this fascinating book, Deborah, you share that Digna Valle, an infamous drug trafficker from Honduras, inspired you to write this. What is her story?
So I first found out about Digna when she was sitting in immigration detention in the United States. And after being arrested in 2013 on a trip to Miami, she essentially helped the American government bring down her drug trafficking clan, which included her older brothers, as well as her own children. She and her family were based on the Honduran border with Guatemala and with drug transporters who helped shepherd a lot of the cocaine that was moving up from Colombia on its way to the United States. And I was just kind of fascinated about, you know, this, the photo of her was, you know, this sort of woman in her early 60s. She just kind of contradicted all these sort of gender tropes around the drug trade. You know, I think we've kind of been led to believe that all of the women in organized crime of any relevance are sort of the glamorous accessories of the famous male traffickers. And she just didn't fit any of those expectations and those kind of gender tropes that we have.
I mean, you're fascinated by her clearly, and yet you don't get to meet her until, ironically, you get to her village, El Espiritu, when she's in detention in the U.S. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I asked her for an interview a couple of times through her immigration lawyer. She declined. I got it. She was applying for the right to stay in the U.S. at the time, and immigration judges do not look kindly on women bragging about their criminal exploits to journalists. And so I figured, well, I'll go to her hometown and see what I can find out about her. I managed to convince the local bishop to accompany me because, in general, drug traffickers love the Catholic Church and they're sort of a good company to have. And we ended up sitting down and chatting for hours with the women who lived right next door to her. And as we were chatting, you know, one of the women came out from the back of the house and she said, pues aquí tengo Digna, like I have Digna here on video call. Would you like to talk to her? And I remember sort of looking back at my colleagues and we were clearly being flagged. You know, these women were her close allies and they were clearly letting Digna know that I was asking around after her right on her doorstep. So it was rather an unnerving moment.
So the other women you profile, what roles have they played in the cartels and what motivates them?
So, you know, Digna was a transporter. A little bit further north, there was a woman called Sebastiana who also shepherded cocaine across the border into Mexico for the Sinaloa cartel. Then there was Marjorie Chacon Rossell, who was a Guatemalan. She took over money laundering from her husband, who was a money launderer of the Colombian organizations, and sort of excelled and outshone him. And then you had Guadalupe Fernandez Valencia, who was, today, as far as I understand it, the highest ranking woman in the Sinaloa cartel that we know of. And I was fascinated by how she was kind of this all-rounder female figure right at the top of the Sinaloa cartel, and yet completely unknown. You know, her name is by no means a household one in the way that her boss's was.
So how do women in the drug trade prove their worth?
I don't think it's possible to sort of pigeonhole a rise, you know, like some of the women that I profiled definitely were violent. They had no qualms about killing with their own hands. But a lot of the killing in organized crime is outsourced. You know, you don't do it yourself. You send your people to do it. And women are as capable as that as anyone else. I feel like within Latin American societies, there's this figure of the sort of sacred mother. You know, that's especially strong in Mexico. It's association with La Virgencita de Guadalupe. And I think there is a trust and an admiration for women and matriarchs within these small rural societies. And I can see how that is power. And the way that women use their power doesn't necessarily have to be violent. I think they have that connection and that kind of place in the community that men sometimes don't have. And they use that. And, you know, a number of prosecutors and criminal defense lawyers in the US who've represented women say that they use the fact that they are less suspect than men to law enforcement, they're more trusted than men to the community, to further their family's business interests.
But you're saying that there is this kind of stereotype of a nurturing narco because they're women?
I think it's really uncomfortable for society to accept that women who are mothers and sisters and wives are also capable of criminality. And so I think we tended to turn away from that because it's, you know, it's deeply uncomfortable. And all of these women brought their children into the drug business, got them involved, which also kind of really conflicts with this idea of women as caring, nurturing, soft members of organizations and families.
The title of your book is Narcos, not to be confused with Narcos. And it occurs to me that that TV series Narcos really glorifies, many say, drug kingpins. Did you worry about glorifying drug trafficking with this book?
I did. The narrative is a fine line between recognizing the empowerment and rise of these women without glorifying the fact that they worked for these viscerally criminal organizations and very violent groups.
Deborah Bonello is an editorial director for Latin America at Vice World News and author of the just released Narcos, The Secret Rise of Women in Latin America's Cartels. Deborah, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you. Lovely to speak to you as always.
It's got a familiar bossa nova guitar, then the song opens up to a lush orchestral arrangement. Brazilian musician and composer Arthur Verosai arrives for his first U.S. tour ever this week, along with a 30-piece orchestra. Verosai will reprise this groundbreaking album he composed in 1973. He slyly released it during the Brazilian dictatorship that suppressed a lot of creativity. It didn't get a lot of acclaim at the time, but Verosai's work has been cited by many Brazilian artists as the bridge to a more complex, funkier sound, and more recently, sampled by the likes of Common and Ludacris. You've got four chances to hear it live in August, 3 dates on the West Coast and 1 in Chicago. That is our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again tomorrow.